Reopening schools is causing a lot of tension here in the Commonwealth. School districts have been planning scenarios to return for months, and a growing number are opting to start with all remote learning. Then, just this week, Governor Baker released guidelines saying cities and towns with low coronavirus infection rates should opt for in-person learning this fall.
Those communities are in a perfectly appropriate place to have kids back.
Yesterday at the State House, a group of parents showed their support for reopening in person, and Channel 5 captured that scene.
Bring kids back! Bring kids back!
But not everyone's sure that's a good idea, such as Antonetta Brunell, a Boston Public Schools parent and teacher.
Yes, maybe there might be some lost learning. That's not going to kill them, but COVID can.
So all this hour, we are going to talk about reopening and we're going to take your calls. We're going to dive into one district that's particularly high need, Boston Public Schools. We'll talk to city leaders and parents about how they're managing the school system's decision to go at least partially online this fall. And later in the hour, we'll take your calls with Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Caselius. But first, we want to turn to WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young to help set the table and give us the big picture of the conversations happening around reopening schools right now. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Carrie, we can hear the tension in the sounds there. And there's a new WBUR poll out that shows that about half of residents respondents want hybrid learning. Of course, that means about half probably don't. So can you break those numbers down for us?
Yeah, so you're right. About half do want that hybrid learning, but only about 15% say that they want kids in schools full time. It also breaks things down by racial differences among people of color. It says about 40% prefer online learning, and that's compared to about 28% of white respondents.
So how do we match that up with what school districts are actually planning to do?
Yeah, so districts have a deadline of tomorrow to get their plans to the state. And according to the state, who's looked at all of these as they've been coming in, most schools are planning to go hybrid. There are some notable districts, though, that are starting remotely. I know there's Everett and Somerville are some of them. And then several districts did want to go hybrid, Salem in particular. But then just recently they announced, because their average daily coronavirus cases are on the rise and hitting concerning levels, that they're actually going to reverse course and start remotely.
So, Carrie, then yesterday, Governor Baker released new guidelines that match up school reopening plans with local COVID-19 infection rates. How does that work?
Yeah, so it's sort of a color coding system, and it's based on community's average daily case rate. So if you're in the red, that means you have a case rate of greater than 8. And that is suggesting that schools in those areas go remote only. Then there's yellow, that's between 4 and 8 average daily cases. If you're in the yellow, then the recommendation there is that you go remote or hybrid. That option opens up there. And then there's green and white, and that's less than 4 average daily cases. And essentially, the governor has said that communities in those particular categories with those lower rates, he says he doesn't see why they wouldn't open.
If you're in a green or a white community, I can't imagine a good reason not to go back, whether it's full-time or in some sort of a hybrid, because for all intents and purposes, you meet all the benchmarks that are being used across the country and across New England to make decisions about whether it's safe to go back to school.
Yeah, and the timing of this to me was kind of interesting. You know, as we've mentioned, the final drafts of the district reopening plans are due tomorrow. So this was really important information for districts to be working with, and it came in at the very last minute with just days to go, really.
Yeah, to your characterization of interesting timing, how are school districts reacting to this, especially those who have made remote learning plans, but maybe the governor's guidelines suggest that their district should do something else?
Yeah, I mean, so school leaders, superintendents are really under a lot of pressure right now. And from what I'm hearing from a good many of them is this is too little too late, you know, because originally, you know, the first deadline for these plans was that they should be into the state by last Friday. That was extended to this week. But, you know, some school committees have already passed their plans. You know, and the others that haven't already, they said, well, it can still be useful for determining when to reopen or go away from fully remote in the future. But yeah, it's definitely frustrating. I spoke with Tom Scott, who is the executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents. And he says it would have been really great to have this information like 3 weeks ago. Here's what he said.
By not having things well in advance of decisions that have to be made, it provides opportunities for poor decision making or for conflict between different perspectives on how to solve this.
And as we heard in, you know, in our intro here, there is a lot of conflict and tension. So, you know, in his opinion, that extra information would have helped with the planning and maybe eased some of that.
So what are you hearing from parents? They've been giving a lot of feedback in the last few weeks, particularly.
Well, it really depends. You know we mentioned our poll data with about 40% or 50% responding that they would prefer, some type of in-person learning. I know Boston Public Schools had a poll that went out to parents with similar results. They said about 40% of their respondents indicated a direct preference for hybrid learning models. But that doesn't work for everyone, some parents are saying. You know, some working parents say that they don't like the idea. And, you know, parents with kids who have certain disabilities say remote and hybrid learning just aren't viable options for them. Roxy Harvey spoke about this last night at a city council hearing. She's the Special Education Parent Advisory Council chair. And she says she has a child with high needs and with a high needs disability, rather, and he's Black and Hispanic. And here's how she's sort of been reacting to these recommendations.
You cannot tell me as a parent that I am sending my child to die if I choose to make an informed decision and send him for in-person services while everyone else is at the park, the beach, in-person summer camps, and other places.
You know, and then again, we also have parents like we heard in the beginning of the segment who said they just don't want to take the chance of either their child getting COVID or maybe passing it on to a loved one who might be at risk. That, you know, learning at home is not going to kill them in the long run, but COVID could.
Okay, so I'm hearing so much tension, so much uncertainty. We're going to talk about this for the rest of the hour. Carrie, I'm delighted to know that you're going to stay with us for that hour. Sit tight with us now. Listeners, we are going to go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to take a deep dive into one of those districts, the Boston Public Schools. All this hour, we are talking about the challenges of beginning a new school year in the midst of a pandemic. Parents have been waiting for months to get some clarity on exactly what that's going to look like. But just as we talked about with Carrie before the break, so much is still up in the air, and now we're just a few short weeks away. That lack of clarity, combined with this realization that resources are scarce, many parents have to work, remote learning will almost certainly be at least part of the picture, that means parents and community leaders are having to get really creative about preparing for the toughest possible scenarios. We want to hear from you. How are you preparing? Have you had to get creative? What did you come up with? What are you going to do? And are you partnering with others? What challenges or obstacles have you had to overcome, maybe from remote learning last spring, and you're planning for them again? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So joining us now are two guests who got really creative. First, we have Boston City Councilor Julia Mejia, who recently obtained a grant to set up a learning pod in the Lena Park Community Center in Dorchester. Councilor Mejia, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. And I just want a point of a clarification. Sherita Fouché, who's on the line with us, it's the organization that she's a co-director of that received the grant. And I'm happy that she's going to be joining us for this conversation.
Yes, and that would be my next introduction, Sherita Fouché, who is the director of that learning pod and co-director of the Collaborative Parent Leadership Action Network. Sherita, welcome to Radio Boston as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Councilor Mejia, I'm going to start with you. Where did this idea come from, and how does the pod idea work?
Well, with all things that deal with parents, it's really about how can we be resourceful during these times. I think of this concept more like a mutual aid. I'm sure you saw a lot of those pop up during COVID, where people were trying to identify how they can help and what they can do. So it's really taking that concept of a mutual aid and really applying it to the education space. You know, there are a lot of parents who are working from home. I know for me, I struggle. Working from home and trying to do remote learning was a big challenge for me as a single mom. And really was what opportunities can we create to ensure that teachers and schools are supported during remote learning, and so are families. And so really the idea was really came about is in terms of being a problem, a solution to a problem that a lot of families were having. And with all the uncertainty, the fact that the plans are due on the 14th and it's the 13th, and there are so many parents that are still waiting to hear what the final plan is for BPS. It was really an opportunity for parents and nonprofit organizations and community partners and residents to come together and brainstorm as a collective of what can we all do together to address this issue.
So let's turn to Sherita then, Councillor Mejia. Sherita, as a result of that brainstorming, how is this pod going to work? You're the director. What are the mechanics of this? How does it work?
Absolutely. Although the need is great, recognizing that safety is the top concern and priority for all, we started with a small group of students who will come to Lena Park to engage with their remote learning at their respective schools. Each pod, because there's three pods within Lena Park, will engage with their remote learning throughout the day with support from a pod leader and pod assistant. One of the things that was a struggle for many children was connecting remotely and navigating platforms and needing additional support related to the content that they were learning. So they'll be able to have that within a safe space with adults who are supporting the learning and adults who are also communicating with their schools so that it feels like one community. And one shared goal, which is really to support children and family during this time. So students will come to the pod, get their remote learning, which will have also additional extracurricular activities for the students who are there. And we will do so being really respectful of the safety guidelines and protocols.
And so just to be clear, the students will be participating in remote learning that is being offered by their school, but in small clusters across grades with guides who will be there helping them. So both they have a place to be kind of outside the home and together, and some sort of facilitation or assistance in doing the remote learning that's being provided by their school classroom. Am I understanding that correctly?
Correct.
And this is 20 kids total, right?
20 kids for this particular pod, yes.
Okay, and Councillor Mejia, what type of grant did it take to fund 20 kids to do this? To fund this for 20 kids is probably a better answer.
Sherita could talk a little bit more about the grant. It was given to the organization that she leads. But what I will say is that the whole idea was really about how do we take this? Everyone's taking a risk, right? At this time, in this moment in time, there's a lot of problems, but not a lot of innovation. And so really, how do we seize this moment to help other pods and other organizations and other groups across the city take this model and replicate it? So the goal and the concept would be is that this is just a group, a cohort of 20 kids. But, through the work that Sherita has been doing, she's been working with groups from East Boston, Alston and Brighton, Roxbury, other parts of Dorchester and Mattapan, and providing training and technical assistance and resources to help other pods pop up throughout the city. They all wouldn't fall, I don't think they will be falling under seed plan, but it's the grant was really more about how do we create this opportunity for students across the city, and how do we utilize this innovation to help support other parents and educators and nonprofit groups and volunteers who are really looking to be engaged and to help support working families. So Sherita can tell you a little bit more about the grant process and the goals and objectives, but it's not just the 20 students that are being served. It's really about how are we utilizing these resources to support other pods, for instance, through supplies, resources, technical assistance, like creating a resource hub. And Sherita had a really amazing idea of creating even a network of pods where they would meet on a monthly basis to share best practices and what are the issues that they are experiencing as they're, you know, facilitating their pods to help support the learning.
So
ultimately, the goal is that this is not something that will be a long term. This is just something to get us through the next, hopefully the next few months while things settle.
So Sharita, just briefly, what size of a grant does it take to do this? How much money does it take?
I think one of the things is that we, as we have these conversations across, there is no magic number, right? And I think it's not necessarily about money, but about people power. And so one of the things that CPLAN has always done is to try to amplify the parent voice in a lot of spaces, because a lot of the times conversations are had about students and about families and not within conjunction. And when you take that voice and that lens from it, you also remove some of the resources that are in our communities. And so we have very resource-rich communities that have been ignored for quite some time. So for a lot of folks, it seems amazing that this could happen in these communities. And we've been kind of saying all along, if you allow us a seat at the table, we have so much to offer. So I don't think that there is a specific denomination. I think when we talk about students, one of the traps that we fall into is speaking about numbers. I think we are learning that every pod is unique and every pod is different and every pod has different needs. And so what we're trying to do is pool all of these resources together and then be able to address the need per pod, recognizing the unique differences and contributions that they all make. And so,
all right, let's go. Go ahead, Sharita.
I just want to say something really quick before we move on. I just wanted to share one thing that has been amazing and beautiful to see is that, you know, there are two nonprofit groups in East Boston in particular that are now going to pool their resources together, their human capital, if you will, to focus on creating a pod that is designed specifically for the families that they've already been serving. And instead of providing their programming after school, now they're going to repurpose and provide programming during the day to help satisfy this need. There are other pods that parents are who have the luxury and the privilege of being able to work from home are saying, well, I'll volunteer a few hours in the pod. There are other pods that are looking at partnering up with different issue-based organizations to provide very specific type of learning instruction. Like there's a micro farm in Dudley who now is excited to open up their farm to students so that they can learn about farming. And then there's another nonprofit that we've been talking to. It's a shelter. How do we get women who are in shelter, who are homeless and living in shelters to utilize this concept as a way to build community? So what has come up as a way to deal with one issue has turned into something so incredibly beautiful. But what it has taught us and what is continuing to surface is that as communities, we are resource rich, but coordination poor. And when we have a concept that can be adopted and embraced, there's nothing that we can't overcome. And COVID is
that one certainly of the things. There's so much that's inspiring that. I mean, you guys have just laid out a lot of information about how it works, what resources have been able to be leveraged, how much latent idea and capacity was there. I want to turn to Carrie Young for just a minute. Carrie, are we seeing pods develop in other communities around the state? And then I want to dive in a little bit. I want to take a call and I want to dive into a little bit on the pros and cons of this pod kind of approach in different school districts. Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, in several of my calls this last week or so, I know like one interesting plan I heard was one school leader told me, you know, we're thinking of having our school open and sort of act as a pod. So teachers who feel safe enough to come in and lead those pods, it's open for, you know, students who might need a place to be during the day, or where learning from home is just not an option. I know like YMCAs, you know, other community centers, I think there is a lot of discussion going on right now. I am not quite sure how much has been, completely solidified, but those talks are going on around the state, really.
Let's go to the phones quickly. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about creative solutions that parents and communities can take to solving household problems, online learning problems, etc., as we get ready to go back to an unprecedented school year. We've got Jerry on the phone from Medford. Jerry, go ahead.
Yes. So I have two kids in elementary school, and I've been talking with another family. In Medford, we are being offered the option of hybrid or fully remote. I've been talking to another family around the corner, two kids the same age, about being a pod with them for fully remote. But I'm really curious about this new map that the state has and the green and yellow and red areas. And we're Medford just on the border between two areas. And I wonder where the state came up with these limits of 4 or 8 cases per 100,000 and how we know that what numbers are going to be safe for kids to be in school and what numbers are going to be too high.
That's a great question, Jerry. And I want to turn to first Sherita and then Counselor Mejia. You'd be welcome to join in as well. When you got that guidance from the state, you know, as somebody who works in this area, did those numbers feel solid to you? Do you feel like you understand where they come from? Are those thresholds that you trust?
I think we've been really cautious about taking all information in, but recognizing regardless of what information is being poured in, how parents feel about these data points and this information that's shared as it relates to their family specifically. And I think it's really easy to talk high level, but as a parent, when you're talking about any possible opportunity for a child to be exposed, is too much. It's great to know that numbers are low, but any risk is too much risk at all. And so I think parents need to really think about what that means for them and what their choices are. And I'm grateful that communities are coming together to have these conversations to expand upon parents' choice and families' choice. And I think
Sherita,
we can't go wrong.
So I'm really struck. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm really struck by something you just said. I think you just said that any risk is too much risk. And I think about that. I'm gonna play you some sound from a woman named Jennifer Inferno, who's a parent in the Winchester public school system. She wants her kids to go back to school. Here she is.
I, like many parents, had to wake up every morning with a lot of guilt and anxiety about whether or not I would prioritize my job or whether or not I would prioritize my children's education. But for the youngest learners, they're not able to learn on their own, and it really requires parent facilitation the entire time.
So, you know, there's a struggle there, too. Clearly, she's got the ability to work at home, be present, assist her children. But we are having this conversation, and I'm interested in both of your reactions, about what the right balance of risk is, because are there not risks of harm to kids who may need other services, may need in-school supports, may fall behind because they're not able to engage in a quality way with remote learning? How are the two of you thinking about that in this creative work that you're doing?
Yeah, I think, you know, and my heart is so heavy when I hear all of the different scenarios that so many parents are being met with. I think that, in my grand scheme of things, I would hope that the district would open up the schools to a smaller cohort of students who are the most vulnerable learners, whether it be students who are on IEPs or English language learners, or students who require more one-on-one, if you will. And then creating these learning pods in neighborhoods like the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club, and other little and nonprofit organizations to help support the learning. Because it's not just about going back to school. What I find to be really startling, it's not just about the academics. It is about the social and emotional well-being of students and the trauma that kids are experiencing from the social isolation that remote learning is causing. We're not talking about that. And that is why the solution around creating these smaller cohorts of community pods where kids can still be in community with 10 kids or 5 or whatever the pod composition is, it satisfies both the safety concern and it also gives families specifically working families an opportunity to send their kids to one place. The problem that a lot of families have right now is that the hopscotch model that's being presented, it's 2 days a week and then 3 days of uncertainty, right? That's one of the biggest things that I've heard from working families of that what they're struggling with. But
Counselor Mejia, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but we are running out of time for this segment. I'm so grateful to you, Counselor Julia Mejia, for joining us, and Sherita Fauché, Director of the Learning Pod at the Lena Park Community Center in Dorchester and co-director of the Collaborative Parent Leadership Action Network. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were talking about learning pods and other creative ways parents are preparing to manage the complexities of schooling this fall. The same question faced school districts across the state. How exactly to handle things in September, which is a mere 2 weeks away? Here is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh yesterday at City Hall.
We have a COVID pandemic, and we have a race. We have a crisis of race and equity. We have to get this right. Our kids are depending on us doing this. These are safety issues for many of our children. We have to meet those needs from the first day school begins, or those students will suffer. We can't, and we're not going to let that happen.
So WBUR education reporter Carrie Young has joined us for the hour, is still with us. And for the rest of the show today, we will be taking your calls on schools and reopening with Brenda Caselius, superintendent of the state's largest school district, the Boston Public Schools. Call us. Are you a parent, student, or teacher in Boston? What are your questions for the superintendent? Folks outside the city, what's your district doing? Have they decided? Are you concerned? Share your thoughts. What are you thinking about as we creep towards September? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Superintendent Brenda Caselius, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's so great to speak with you today.
So I want to begin with a very practical question. We are seeing reports in the last couple of hours that Boston is planning on delaying the school start date from September 10th to September 21st. Just want to clarify those reports. Is that the case? Can you confirm that new start date?
Yes, we are planning on doing a September 21st start date to give us some time to be able to have teachers be prepared and to get in the classrooms, welcome students and parents back through student conferences, virtual student conferences, and to then walk our buildings and make sure that they're ready.
So what will that mean timing-wise for everyone involved? Have dates shifted for everyone? And will you still phase in who comes into the building if any students come in?
So we have yet to still make the decision on what that looks like in terms of remote option for parents, which they'll always be able to choose a remote option, as well as our hybrid model and what that will look like, whether that would be a slower phase-in with younger students or a special population of students, or whether we would try to do a full hybrid when we return. And the reason that is because we really want to watch the science a little bit more these next couple of weeks. And be able to adjust if we need to.
So, Superintendent, I want to clarify on that because this has been a little bit confusing, I think, in a number of districts. Each district must report a set of plans to the state by close of business tomorrow. But that doesn't mean that, for example, the Boston Public Schools have determined which scenario in that plan you are going to use on September 21st. Is that correct?
Well, the commissioner asked us to actually turn in three different plans, one for all in person, one for all remote, and one that's a hybrid. And so then what he has asked us to do is to indicate our preferred model, fully understanding that at any point in the year, we may move from one model to the next. And he is wanting to make sure we're prepared for all of the above in our preparations.
And what is your preferred model that you're telling the state?
So currently right now, the science is indicating that we would be able to open up hybrid. That is where we're at, but that doesn't mean that the science may not change and we would need to go full remote. And we just don't know what that hybrid exactly will look like in terms of if we would open for just a subset of population of students who have high needs, or whether that would be a phased in or by grade level, we're still determining that.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you a Boston Public School parent? family member, teacher, or maybe in another district where you're also wondering how this is going to work for your family, for your child, for your school community. If you have questions for Superintendent Brenda Caselius, call us. We will take them. Superintendent, you probably saw Adrian Walker's column in the Globe this week saying it is time for the Boston Public Schools to make a decision one way or another. And I do wonder about that. You know, people have to plan, and we're only a couple of weeks away from September. Now, obviously, you've added 11 days, which will give some buffer there. But when will families really know what they can expect? You know, do you know, is there a drop-dead date by which you will make a final decision about how it's going to work when you start?
Well, again, you know, I did say that this is an evolving and emerging issue with the science. We know that we've seen some uptick in our numbers the past couple of weeks here. I am working closely with the mayor, as you alluded to earlier, as well as the Boston Health Commission and Chief Marty Martinez. And then also, you know, just recently, the governor issued just a few days ago new guidance around opening. So, you know, these things continue to change. However, I do recognize, and parents told us in their survey, that they want to have predictability and certainty. So we are anticipating to be able to make this decision rather soon. It's hard for me to put an absolute day on it, but I do understand the uncertainty. There is an urgency. We do know that they want to plan. Teachers want to know, and principals want to know. And so, you know, we are attempting to make this decision as soon as possible as we can.
What do you say to listeners out there who may be in your school district? I know that in your heart you understand this, who are sitting there thinking, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I've got so much I've got to figure out. What is your message to them right now over these next couple of weeks as we continue to follow the science and sort things out?
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to be weeks. You know, I think it's going to be sooner than that. And so I just don't want to pin down an absolute date, because I am working in collaboration with the mayor, and there's a number of indicators we're looking at. As I said, the governor just put out his guidance. And so it's, you know, I would say they won't be waiting weeks.
Superintendent, you just referred to the governor putting out this new guidance, these guidelines on reopening, which seems to have been a surprise, at least to most players. Were you surprised by those new guidelines? And how are they going to affect even what you turn into the state tomorrow? Have you had to shift anything as a result of those coming out yesterday?
Well, we're in the yellow zone now that he has, which is, you know, to open hybrid or remote with exception for those who have exceptions. And so that means that if we're in remote only, we would need to, I think, provide additional evidence on why we're in remote only. And so, you know, that could shift some of our planning as we think and as we go forward. But, you know, we are getting new guidance from the state a lot. You know, typically every week there's something new that's coming through. We just got some guidance around athletics. So I haven't even had a chance to go through it all yet. So there's it is just constantly evolving, unfortunately. And I know that's very hard for the public to hear. It's also very hard for us as we try to lead and provide information to the community. So I fully, fully understand. And I want to provide these answers as soon as we possibly can.
I want to talk about risk calculus for a little bit, because as we listen to conversations held by various superintendents and school committees and between teachers and parents, it feels like there's kind of a continuum of how much risk is worth it. You know, from no amount of risk of getting the infection is worth it, kids need to learn remotely, to we got to balance some risk because there are other risks of loss. And I'm thinking about shortfalls of remote learning. Is there some point at which this risk calculus from the losses of remote learning, of lack of other services, of teachers not necessarily being able to have eyes on kids to catch kids who may fall through the cracks in other types of danger, domestic violence or parental neglect, et cetera, where that starts to outweigh the risks of contagion or counterbalance the risks of contagion? How do you think about that?
Well, you heard the mayor talking about this in his press conference just the other day, and obviously this is a this weighs very heavy on my heart and on the heart of the whole community, really, is that we know that kids who are more vulnerable are impacted at a much greater rate, as well as we know that our students who have disabilities. I was listening to a community call just on Saturday, and there was a parent on there it was just heart-wrenching to hear her talk about how challenging it was for her personally at home with her child because of the regression that was happening and the support that she needed. And so there is a huge need out there for students who didn't engage with us over the spring or are impacted negatively now with their learning. And this is especially true, the new study out today, and around the younger students and the impacts at the early childhood grade levels, you know, students who are age 3 through age 10, and just their own child development. So certainly balancing that with the contagion and the community spread is important. But we believe, and the science has said, that if we follow these guidelines and protocols around wearing a mask and saying, you know, having the airflow, staying 6 feet apart and washing hands regularly and doing the health checks and not coming to school if you're sick, that seems to be mitigating the risk to where the balance tends to be where you could open for at least special populations. We know that internationally there are countries who are doing this well and are able to mitigate that risk.
So I'd like to go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Lou on the line from East Boston. Lou, you are on with Superintendent Caselius.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You mentioned creative solutions. I went to a small public school in Mendon, Massachusetts, and we had a large outdoor space. Restaurants have been able to adapt and have outdoor seating. Have you thought of the idea of doing outdoor classrooms?
I have, and I was actually talking to, I think it's called the Hale Conservatory today, on a call with about 80 partners. And so Boston After School and Beyond did a pilot with us this summer to expand summer school options and to improve some of the coordination with the schools around academic enrichment to accelerate learning and mitigate learning loss. And some of those partners included some of our outdoor partners. I'm trying to think of the island name now. I don't know why I'm losing it. that's here. And then also the conservatory. So, and then our schools have gardens and they have outdoor spaces. And we are very much encouraging outdoor play and outdoor spaces because we know that it's safer in those areas.
Superintendent Caselius, you may know that riding along with me on the show today is WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. And I want to talk about some of the race and equity issues. Carrie has some data from a new poll, a WBUR poll, about the racial difference in who feels it's time to go back to school in person, who wants hybrid learning, and who wants all remote. Carrie, can you lay out a little bit of that data for us, please?
Yeah, I mean, among people of color, 40% of the respondents said that they do prefer the fully online learning model, and that is compared to 28% of white respondents. And, you know, some of this data does break down to when you compare like Western Massachusetts versus the Boston area and suburbs and things like that. You know, the highest number of people who want fully in-person are in that Western Massachusetts area where some of those infection rates are a little bit lower. It also breaks down on party lines too. Significantly more Democrat voters said that they would like fully remote schooling as opposed to some kind of hybrid or even all in person.
So, Superintendent Caselius, you've talked a couple of times already in our conversation here about issues of race, of equity, of not leaving kids behind. What are the unique challenges for the Boston Public Schools right now, and how do we get at these differences in preferences based on racial identities that are disproportionately affected by this pandemic in general?
Yeah, so I thought of it's Thompson Island, so got that right.
I thought it was Thompson, but I wasn't sure, and there were a lot of islands.
You know, I'll tell you, I got a lot of information going in, but and a little bit of a senior moment there. So, you know, this is the unique challenge that we have in front of us, because you see that the persons of color number at 40% is not matched to where the need is in terms of typical achievement gaps, disparities, the need for additional childcare, the need for services that are provided to many of our children. And so, and then the white families at 28%, I believe, you know, and these are statewide numbers, right? They're not just Boston.
Yes.
Right. So statewide, you know, if you think about it statewide and concentrated poverty that we have here in Boston as well, and the nature of our facilities compared to the nature of the facilities across the state, you know, it could be different in some of our more suburban communities where they've had, you know, HVAC systems, or they may have different experiences and advantages and privileges that aren't afforded to our students here in Boston and the experience. And I think this is also true that our students of color, they've just been impacted more by COVID. You know, they have been impacted in housing. They've been impacted in food security. They've been impacted, you know, academically, and it's just a lot more impacts. And so it is such an incredible complex challenge to balance this very, very difficult decision because of all of that.
So Superintendent Caselius, we have a caller on this, and it's a question I wanted to ask you too, because there was a Globe article today suggesting that there are public health experts who think a hybrid model could be a public health disaster. And we have a caller we won't get to who I think was actually advocating a year off because the level of risk that a child could die. What is your response to this new news that some public health experts think hybrid could be disastrous?
Well, I think that the reason that they have said that is because of the time that's out of school and the potential that students could go to childcare and be in a different type of environment and then come back into the family pods that we have, you know, for their homeroom classes. And so I think that that's why they think that that could increase the spread. I don't really have an opinion about that other than to continue to look at the science and to continue to better understand it. And we believe that, and science has said that if we are able to put in place these protocols, then we are able to mitigate the risk to our students. And again, our students would come on Monday and Tuesday and then have the 3 days off and then not come again until the following Monday and Tuesday. And then we would do this deep cleaning in the space and do the deep cleaning on the weekends. So that's the protocols that we have. And of course, you know, we don't want students coming sick if they do come sick. And we have protocols, again, for that and requiring of testing to return to the environment.
Before we let you go, we've got about a minute left with you. I want to widen this out and ask you a little bit broader question. It's been a tumultuous first year for you. You've gotten support from a prominent group of Black ministers. You've been challenged for your management style. You've gotten pushback from principals on reforming the high schools in the way that you want to and in the pace that you want to. You're also managing a reopening in a global pandemic. There is a lot facing you. How are you balancing the health needs of everyone, the educational and reform goals that you have, the concerns of parents and teachers? How are you trying to keep that at all in balance?
Well, you know, the first year of a superintendency is always a challenge because you're getting to know a new community and you have a lot, it's a big learning curve. And it's a large organization with 10,000 employees, and we count on each other quite a bit to build the team and to rally and get ready for our children in every instance, and just kind of keep our focus on equity and continue to work our strategic plan the best that we can. And then, you know, mitigate whatever we have to mitigate with this current pandemic crisis. It is a lot. There is a lot on the plate, but you just continue to lead and take the next step The next right step is what I like to like to tell my team. No matter what comes at us, we just continue to take the next right step. And we have an incredibly talented team here at Boston Public Schools who care deeply about children, talented teachers who are passionate about our kids and around social justice and equity issues. And as long as we keep children at the center and we measure everything in child benefit, I think we're going to get there.
So that's Brenda Caselius, superintendent of the Boston Public Schools. Superintendent, I hope you'll come back and have additional conversations with us as your tenure continues.
I will, certainly. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. All right, so now I'm going to turn back to WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, you've been with us the whole hour helping us make sense of this all, thinking about the fall, all we've heard on the show today in the last couple of weeks. What are the two or three most fundamental questions that schools need to answer before they open in September?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that we heard Dr. Caselius mention several times is like, we need to rely on the science, you know, and the state has come out with some of its own guidance, but, you know, it is up to the individual district. So they have to decide what their cutoff points are. You know, and I know like one of the big areas that school leaders are trying to balance right now are, you know, just how to, you know, make sure the needs of teachers and kids and their families are met in this time. I'm not sure if there is a perfect answer there, but that's still one of the big looming questions that I think a lot of people are having to figure out right now.
Carrie, there is so much tension here. It's political, it's personal, it's public health, and I don't know and haven't encountered anyone on any side of it for whom they're not feeling it in their heart and in their gut. Have you seen anything like this in your time reporting on education?
You know, I have not. I mean, this really just has so completely impacted the education system. I mean, I think one day that really sticks out to me is, you know, going into the Boston Public Schools building when it was shut down. It's usually a very active place. It's sort of a community building. And when COVID first shut everything down, I mean, no one was there. You know, everyone was sort of in emergency mode. This is just above and beyond any kind of emergency that I have seen here in Boston or even just my other reporting career elsewhere in the Southwest.
And in our last 15 seconds or so, is there a good course forward, or are we really just stuck with less bad options given the circumstances?
Yeah, I think there is not a definition for what is good in this sense. It's going to be community by community. So, and there's always room for a last minute change. So,
well, WBUR education reporter Carrie Young, it's been great to have you today. Thanks for riding along with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.